Welcome, and thank you for standing by. All participant lines are in listen-only mode at this time. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to your host, David Prosper, NightSky Network Administrator. Thank you. You may begin.
Hi, everyone. This is Dave Prosper from the NASA NightSky Network here at the Astronomical Society of the Pacific in San Francisco, California. I'm really excited to present this teleconference with our guest speaker, Brian Day from NASA's Lunar Atmospheric and Dust Environment Explorer, or LADEE. This won't be the first time we've heard from Brian. In the past, he's talked with the NightSky Network on the LCROSS mission, which impacted the moon in order to find water below the surface in a shadowed crater, and the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has been dutifully mapping the moon. And he even gave us a preview of LADEE a couple of years ago, so it's great to have our favorite lunar expert back to tell us the latest and greatest details on our latest mission to the moon, especially now that it's up and returning data. Now, before we get started, I want to make sure that you can all view the presentation slides. If you don't have the slides up in front of you at the moment, you can download them at astrosociety.org/NSNTelecon. And if you have any problems along the way, feel free to email us at nightskyinfo@astrosociety.org. Now, for a brief minute before we start, I'd like to hear from the folks joining us tonight. I'd like to briefly open up the lines, and if you could just give us your name and tell us where you're calling from and what club you're with, we'll have an idea of who's out there listening in.
Darian O'Brien, the Darian O'Brien Astronomy Club in Lakewood, Colorado.
Audrey Fisher, Chicago Astronomical Society in Chicago.
Barb Dibel, Berks Astronomy in Redding, Pennsylvania.
Chris Dirty, Tinkler, Astronomers of Jackson, Michigan.
Bruce Tinkler in Boston, Massachusetts, AFMOB.
Joe Schuster in Salem, Missouri.
Arizona.
Harold Kiley at Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, at ELVAS, Lehigh Valley Amateur Astronomers.
Warren Schindler, the TAAA in Tucson, Arizona.
John Patrick O'Brien from the Darian O'Brien Astronomy Club in Lakewood, Colorado.
John Gallagher of the Hawaiian Astronomical Society in Hawaii.
Yeah, Hawaii.
That was Ben from the Omaha Astronomical Society.
Jim Small at the St. Louis Community College in Merrimack, and I'm here with my astronomy class, and I'm with the St. Louis Astronomical Society.
Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay, Wisconsin.
John Cox from Chago Village, Amateur Astronomers in Mountain Rest, South Carolina.
Patrick O'Leary, Sky Network, Berkeley, California.
Dennis O'Leary, Westchester, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, with the Chester County Astronomical Society.
Bill Vanderberg, Southern Maine Astronomers, Scarborough, Maine.
Annie Gross from Los Angeles Astronomical Society.
Ray Jones, Orlando, Florida, Central Florida Astronomical Society.
Brittany Green, San Francisco, California, San Francisco Astronomer.
Catherine Cintron at the Amateurs Astronomers Association of New York City.
Marissa DeBella, the San Francisco Amateur Astronomers.
Cool. I guess that's it. Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Oh. Okay, so it's great to hear from everyone. If this is your first teleconference with us, welcome. Just follow along with the slides, and there will be time for a brief Q&A at the end of the talk. And also, stick around after the presentation and Q&A, as we'll be giving away a prize pack. Our winner will receive a signed copy of How It Began by Chris Impe, courtesy of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific and Norton Books, plus this brand spanking new copy of the upcoming 2014 Astronomical Society of the Pacific's 125th anniversary calendar. And there's a little bit of news for NightSky Network members. Just as the year is coming to a close, please remember to schedule and log your events in our calendar and encourage your fellow members to do the same, as well as logging your volunteer hours. This helps us better to see what types of events and services your groups perform so we can help figure out and work with you on better ways to serve you, as well as letting NASA and our other grant funders, such as the National Science Foundation, know just how valuable your work is in respective communities and how much work you do. This also helps your clubs and societies better able to keep track of all the great work you do. Many folks are surprised at how much they've done once they take the time to write down just how much outreach and other club-related jobs that they and their fellow members perform. I myself found this out. I was a little shocked. Now it is my great pleasure to introduce our speaker, Mr. Brian Day from LADEE. Brian is joining us again to discuss LADEE, now in orbit around the moon after its amazing launch earlier this year. He has a ton of great information on how to help participate in a mission, what its goals are, and what it has already achieved now that it is swirling away up by lovely Luna. If we're good, he may even give us some insider info on the latest findings as well. Brian has a bit of some allergies tonight, so forgive him, and I think most of us apparently have allergies. It's that time of year, but he's still raring to go, so extra set of applause for him tonight. Brian?
Thank you very much, David, and thank you all for joining us tonight. This is indeed a very special time. As David mentioned, LADEE is in orbit around the moon. Things are going well, and I will be giving you a current update on the status of the mission. But let's start out with a little bit of historical context. So I'm going to advance past the title slide. Let's go to slide number 2. A lot of the impetus behind the current study of lunar volatiles in the lunar atmosphere came about from a realization that there are craters at the poles of the moon whose floors never receive sunlight. The sunlight is coming in essentially horizontally across them. And so there are craters whose floors have not seen sunlight in over a billion years. And people started realizing if volatiles were going to be concentrating anywhere on the surface of the moon, this would be a really good place to look. Moving to slide 3, we see the latest information coming from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter as it actually takes temperatures across the surface of the moon, shows that these permanently shadowed craters really, really do get very, very cold, down to about 25 Kelvin. This is the coldest we have yet measured anywhere in our solar system, even colder than the daytime side of Pluto. So, indeed, these are really good places to look for volatiles. Moving on to slide 4, we see that there was early evidence for water accumulating in these permanently shadowed craters. It was provided by two probes back in the 1990s, the Clementine probe and the Lunar Prospector. But it was just a possibility. The data could be interpreted any number of ways. And so it was a tantalizing hint that there might be water in those craters. Moving on to slide 5, we decided to get our hands wet, to actually excavate one of these craters to see if, in fact, there really was water ice there. And we did this with the LCROSS mission. The idea behind LCROSS was that our robotic spacecraft would hold on to the upper stage of our Atlas V moon rocket and release that upper stage with a mass of about 2 metric tons, moving at 2.5 kilometers per second, flying straight down into one of those permanently shadowed craters, slamming into the ground and excavating hundreds of tons of stuff, flinging it up into the sky of the moon. And then our little robotic spacecraft would fly through the debris, sample it, sniff it, and actually see if there was, in fact, any water ice there. Moving on to slide number 6, you see the dark, permanently shadowed area of the crater Cabeas near the south pole of the moon. This picture was taken by the LCROSS spacecraft. And if you look closely, you'll see that little blip of light right in the center of that shadow. That is the flash from the impact of the Centaur upper stage hitting the ground. Moving on to slide 7, looking at that shadow now, we see this kind of light patch. That is the cloud of debris rising up out of the shadow, the cloud of debris that the L-Cross spacecraft eventually flew through, and that's how we, in fact, discovered that there is indeed water ice in these permanently shadowed areas of the moon. On slide 8, we see that the water ice is actually more widespread than we had previously thought. We were kind of expecting to find it in these permanently shadowed areas. But it turns out that just beneath the surface, even outside of those permanently shadowed areas, just beneath the surface, there appears to be layers of permafrost. At the poles, the sunlight is coming in at such a shallow angle that it does a very poor job of heating up the ground. And so there is potentially a lot more water than we had previously thought. Moving on to slide number 9. Kind of a surprising and fascinating result came from India's Chandrayaan probe. We discovered that there was a thin veneer of water molecules in the soil of the moon, even away from the poles. We didn't really expect to see that. Now, it's not a lot. You'd have to excavate about a football field worth of area to come up with just one standard drinking water bottle's worth of water. But that's not as dry as we thought the moon once was. So moving on to slide 10, the question is, where did this water come from? And we're not altogether sure, but we have some clues. We know that for billions of years, the moon has bombarded by comets, which contain large amounts of water, and a variety of meteoroids and asteroids, some such as carbonaceous chondrites, contain large amounts of water. In addition, the solar wind is a stream of high-energy, high-speed hydrogen atoms slamming into the surface of the moon. Those hydrogen atoms can actually interact with oxygen atoms in the silicates of the lunar minerals, and as a result, you could form water on the surface of the moon. One thing we initially felt very certain of was that this water was all external. It did not come from the moon. The moon itself was initially very, very dry because of the high temperatures under which it formed. Well, we're having to question that now because it turns out that we're getting indications that the magma of the moon actually had a far higher water content than we had initially thought. So we're still learning a whole lot about the moon, and it has a lot of secrets for us. Moving on to slide 11. So the whole concept of a lunar atmosphere is actually a pretty provocative idea. I know I grew up going through school learning that the moon does not have an atmosphere. But in fact, it does. Now, it's a very thin atmosphere. A cubic centimeter of Earth's atmosphere here at sea level contains about 10 to the 19th molecules. If you were to do the same thing on the surface of the moon, take a sample of atmosphere, it only contained about 100,000 to a few million molecules. That's very similar to what our astronauts experience in the outermost fringes of the Earth's atmosphere when they do a spacewalk at the International Space Station. Now, as thin as it is, it's not inconsequential. It turns out the moon's atmosphere is energized by the sun, and it glows. You're actually seeing a picture from here on Earth of the glow of the moon's atmosphere taken through a coronagraph. Now, you may have never noticed the glow of the moon's atmosphere, but that's because it's always right next to the big, bright moon. If somehow you could remove the moon and leave its atmosphere in place, then from a dark sky, you'd be able to look up and actually see the glow of the moon's atmosphere with your unaided eye. Moving on to slide number 12. Technically, the moon's atmosphere is what we call a surface boundary exosphere. What this means is that the atmosphere is so rarefied that it is essentially a collisionless environment. Here on Earth, at the surface of the Earth, the motions of the molecules in our atmosphere are dominated by collisions between those molecules. But in an exosphere, it is rare enough, the atmosphere is thin enough, that it is essentially a collisionless environment, and the molecules are free to carry out ballistic paths governed by the amount of kinetic energy they have and the gravity that is acting upon them. Moving on to slide 13, we see a really interesting animation here showing that the moon's atmosphere is actually blown out into a comet-like tail. And this tail actually extends well beyond the diameter of the moon's orbit about the Earth. As a result, once every month, the Earth actually passes through that tail of lunar atmosphere. Similarly, the Earth's atmosphere is blown by the solar wind into a long tail too, and once a month, the moon passes through that tail of the Earth's atmosphere. So we really are a system. We are not as separated and isolated objects as we had once thought. Moving on to slide number 14. We believe that there's also a dust component, an active dust component, to the lunar atmosphere. We got our first hints about this from the robotic surveyor probes that led up to Apollo. And when these robotic probes would land on the moon, at times they'd look out toward the horizon when the sun would be just below the horizon. And they'd see these strange glows above the horizon. Now, if the moon's sky was empty, you would not expect to see a glow like that because there would be nothing to be reflecting the sunlight into the camera. But in fact, those glows were there. And the initial thoughts were that perhaps this was dust somehow levitated above the surface of the moon. On slide 15, we see continuing support from this came from the Apollo missions when on a number of occasions, astronauts in orbit around the moon in the command module would look out the window, and again with the sun just below the horizon, they would see these beautiful jets and streamers rising high into the sky above the moon, even up to the level at which they were orbiting. Surface instrumentation left on the moon by Apollo 17 astronauts actually gave some further support, showing that there appeared to be transport of dust across the terminator, across the line between day and night on the moon. Moving on to slide number 16, we see that the lunar environment is in fact a far more complicated and dynamic place than we really had ever thought. There is an atmosphere there, and it has numerous inputs. Solar photons coming in and blasting material off the surface of the moon. Solar energetic particles also can liberate molecules from the surface of the moon. The solar wind, meteoroids impacting the moon, from very small micrometeoroids to large impacts. We have outgassing from the interior. We have chemical reactions on the surface of the moon. We have a large variety of things happening, and then it is complicated by the fact that you have this electric charge that builds up differentially between the daytime side and the nighttime side of the moon. So we have actually a pretty complicated dynamic environment. Moving on to slide number 17, we can picture a day in the life of a molecule in the lunar atmosphere. It starts out by sitting on the surface of the moon, waiting for some energetic event to give it a kick. Might be a micrometeoroid, might be a high-energy photon, might be a charged particle. But one of those events happens and our molecule gets a kick. If it has enough energy, it escapes the moon altogether. Otherwise, it will carry out a nice parabolic path, arching up into the sky and landing on the moon surface again, waiting for the next event. And as a result, it can take a random walk around the surface of the moon. Eventually, that random walk may take it to one of those permanently shattered craters, where it ends up freezing out into one of those deposits of frozen volatiles. But even there, there's a lot of high-energy radiation that can sputter the surface of that ice and return those molecules back to the system. As a result, imagine this is a water molecule. You have here the equivalent of a lunar water cycle, which is a really wild idea. We had never thought of saying something like that, you know, 10 years ago. Really interesting stuff. So moving on to slide number 18. Why do we care? Why does any of this matter? Well, it turns out this type of atmosphere that the moon has, this surface boundary exosphere, is an example of the most common type of atmosphere in our solar system. The moon has one. Mercury has one. Larger asteroids, many of the moons of the giant planets, even a number of the distant Kuiper Belt objects, icy worlds out beyond Neptune. This is the most common type of atmosphere in our solar system, and we know very, very, very little about it. But we happen to have one in our own backyard. How lucky is that? So, moving on to slide 19, we are going to study a surface boundary exosphere, the surface boundary exosphere of the moon. And we're doing that with LADEE, the Lunar Atmosphere and Dust Environment Explorer. Its mission is to determine the density, composition, and time variability of the lunar atmosphere, and to do that before it is perturbed by further human activity. There are a lot of missions planned to the moon, and when a mission goes to the moon, well, if it's got, of course, if it's got humans, you know, humans exhale and belch and whatever else they may do, and they come on vehicles with thrusters that fire and put vast amounts of exhaust. All of that could overwhelm the very thin lunar atmosphere. We estimate that with the Apollo missions, each of the lunar module journeys, when that lunar module would fly down to the moon and leave the surface again, it would temporarily double the mass of the lunar atmosphere just from the exhaust of the lunar modules. So the time to do this exploration is now. Moving on to slide number 20. It's actually, you know, even though we're a small mission, it's a big effort. And it is being accomplished by people in a wide variety of places. Mission control and operations, the mission is managed out of Ames Research Center here in Northern California. The Science Operations Center is at Goddard. We have payloads from a variety of locations, and our program office is at Marshall Space Flight Center. So it's definitely a collaborative effort. Moving on to slide 21, you can see a diagram of the LADEE spacecraft. It's not very tall. It's about 2 meters tall. It has a mass of 330 kilograms. 53 of those kilograms are the actual payload mass. We like to say it's big science with a small spacecraft. Moving on to slide 22, let's take a closer look at the payload. We have 3 scientific instruments. We have a mass spectrometer and an ultraviolet invisible light spectrometer that will sniff out the composition of what it is we are flying through. We also have the lunar dust experiment, which will analyze the amount of dust that may be lofted into the lunar sky, as well as the size of the dust particles and any electric charge that may be on them. And then we have a technology demonstration, the Lunar Laser Communications Demo. And the idea there is to try out communications instead of via radio, the way we have always done it in the past, to now try something different, to try doing communications via a laser beam. This provides us with a signal that does not spread out, and therefore we get superior signal strength and therefore data rates. And it also frees us from the crowding that is happening in the radio spectrum now. The idea is to bring broadband speeds to the moon with a goal of getting up to 622 megabits per second. Moving on to slide 23, here you see an image of the Lattice spacecraft going through the integration process as it was being assembled here at NASA Ames Research Center. Slide 24, Lattice was packaged up and sent by truck across the country from California to Virginia for launch at the Wallops Flight Facility. On slide 25, you see Lattice at Wallops being prepared for integration with the launch vehicle. Slide 26, Lattice has now been mated to the fifth stage of the Minotaur 5 rocket that carried us into space, and you can see the payload fairings are being placed around Lattice and the fifth stage. Continuing to slide 27, Lattice was then lifted and placed on top of the four stages that had been stacked for the Minotaur 5 rocket at Pad 0B on Wallops Island on the Atlantic coast of Virginia. Slide 28, we had a spectacular launch. I have to tell you, it put on one heck of a show. And not just for those of us there at Wallops, but also for many millions of people all across the East Coast. We lit up the sky and put on a show from South Carolina up through Canada. It was exciting. Slide 29, here you see a view that we had from Wallops as people watched the rocket streaking into the sky. Slide 30, this is the view from New York City. You've probably seen this picture. Very, very spectacular. And, of course, on slide 31, I could not do this talk without showing the frog. Yes, the poor unfortunate frog that was in a pond near the launch pad, and the blast wave hit that pond and sent the frog flying. This went all over the web, and to my surprise and consternation, it was even featured on Meet the Press the Sunday following the launch. I could not believe it. Moving on, slide 32. So we did, in fact, launch on September 6th. We were the first deep space launch from NASA's Wallops Space Flight Facility. We were the first payload to fly on the brand new Minotaur 5 rocket. We spent 1 month going through three phasing loops going out to the moon. We went into retrograde orbit around the moon and initially went into a checkout orbit at 250 kilometers for about a month. After everything checks out, then we drop down to our science orbit, varying from 20 to 75 kilometers for a 100-day science mission. Moving on to slide number 33. So again, we did have that launch on September 6th. We successfully did our phasing loop maneuvers at the perigee approach of each of those three phasing loops. Those happened on September 13th, 21st, and October 1st. Those got us out to the moon, and on October 6th, we had our encounter with the moon, firing our engine to go into lunar orbit insertion. That initial burn put us into a 24-hour orbit around the moon. A second burn on October 9th then dropped us into a 4-hour orbit around the moon. And our final lunar orbit insertion burn on October 12th dropped us into our commissioning orbit with a 2-hour orbit around the moon at 250 kilometers. After that, we started doing our commissioning orbit. And during that time, we're checking out all the instruments, checking out the systems on the spacecraft. Spacecraft systems checked out okay very quickly. We went through our science instruments, checking those out. And at the same time, that's when we did the tests of the laser communications demonstration. So that was during the commissioning phase. Now, when I sent these slides out, we were looking forward to then dropping down out of our commissioning orbit into our science orbit. And at the time, we were predicting November 14th, we would drop our periapsis down to the science altitude, keeping our apoapsis up high. And then we would take the second step down, finally into our science orbit, on November 24th. Well, things have gone very, very well in our commissioning orbit, and so things moved a little faster. We have already dropped our periapsis down. That happened on November 10th. And we anticipate doing the final step down into our science orbit on November 20th. So things are going well. Moving on to slide 34. Let's talk a little bit about one of the fun things that happened during the commissioning phase, and that was the demonstration of lunar laser communications. So there was the laser terminal on board LADEE itself talking to three ground terminals. The primary one was at White Sands, New Mexico, and secondary stations were in the San Gabriel Mountains in California, and Tenerife on the Canary Islands. So moving on to slide 35, you can see a diagram of how this works. On LADEE, there's a 10-centimeter aperture telescope with a 0.5-watt laser that would communicate to the ground. On the ground station, you had a series of four 15-centimeter aperture telescopes that would shoot a 10-watt laser. Those were the signal up to LADEE. And then there were four 40-centimeter telescopes that were the receivers to receive the information from LADEE. So LADEE could send information down and successfully sent information at 622 megabits per second. And it received information at 20 megabits per second. It worked very, very well. So lunar laser communications has been successfully demonstrated. Moving on to slide number 36. This is getting up to an exciting time now with the science operations of LADEE. And there are ways that amateur astronomers can directly participate in the science of the mission. Now, recall that one of the sources for the lunar atmosphere is meteoroid impacts slamming into the moon. We are very interested in understanding just how important a role those impacts play. And amateur astronomers are uniquely positioned to be able to do this because the flashes from meteoroid impacts on the moon are best observed with 8 to 14-inch telescopes, something that is very common in the amateur community. And so we'd like to establish a network of observers around the world watching the moon during the course of the LADEE mission so that we can compare impact events with any changes that LADEE's instruments see in the structure and composition of the lunar atmosphere. Moving on to slide number 37, you can see that the minimum system requirements, we want an 8-inch telescope that's tracking the moon, an astronomical video camera, doesn't have to be anything very expensive or fancy. Some of the security cameras are turning out to be the best options. A digitizer to take the analog signal and digitize it for your computer, and a computer to store the video files. We also want to have a time encoder so that we have accurate timestamps on the video so that if there is an impact, we know exactly when it happened. And we are able to provide free software that you can use to analyze your video to, in fact, see if there are impact flashes. So going on to slide 38, you can see a schematic of a typical system here, the telescope with a video camera. The signal from the video camera gets joined by the time signal from the GPS system. That combined signal goes to an analog digital converter that is then, and then that is stored on a computer for later analysis. Moving on to slide 39. When do you look? Well, phase actually matters. You don't want to. You see these flashes against the dark portion of the moon, the nighttime side of the moon. So obviously looking around full moon is not a good idea. Looking around new moon is not such a good idea either because, well, the moon's not in the nighttime sky long enough to make observations. Quarter moons are pretty much ideal, but not all quarter moons are created equal. First quarter moon versus third quarter moon. During the first quarter moon, you're actually looking at the leading edge of the moon, and so are more likely to see impact flashes. Looking at third quarter, you're looking at the trailing edge, and so you're less likely. Even so, we'd still like you to look, because we see these impacts regardless of whether it's near first or near third quarter. On slide 40, you see an example of one of these impacts. This was taken by an amateur astronomer, George Varos, and that flash in the video loop that you see in the lower right is probably something about the size of a walnut slamming into the surface of the moon. Slide 41. Well, this is all good and well if you happen to have a 8 to 14 inch telescope with video camera. But there are a lot of people out there who don't, who would still like to participate, and they can. Because it turns out the majority of impactors striking the moon are actually very small, on the order of 1 micron in diameter. And you would never see an impact flash from something that small from here on Earth. However, because the Earth and moon travel together through space, they encounter these streams of debris together. And when even a small piece of debris hits the Earth's atmosphere, it lights up the sky as a meteor. The typical meteor that you see in the sky is caused by an object typically about the size of a grain of sand. So by looking up in the sky and counting meteors in the Earth's nighttime sky during the course of the LADEE mission, and seeing how that number varies from night to night, we can then make inferences as to what is happening on the surface of the moon at that time. So by doing meteor counting, you can actually contribute to the science of the LADEE mission. The beautiful thing about counting meteors is there's virtually no equipment requirement. You do not need a telescope. You do not need binoculars. You do not need hardly anything at all, though I do recommend a lawn chair. You might as well be comfortable. And as is the case with almost everything these days, moving on to the next slide, slide 42, yes, there's even an app for that. NASA's come out with Meteor Counter. It works on iOS and on Android, and your smartphone knows where you are, it knows what time it is. So you take this app out, and you look up at the sky, and you start tapping the screen whenever you see a meteor. Tap on the right side for a bright meteor, left side for a dim meteor, in between for an in-between meteor. It records your count, and at the end of your observing session, uploads this information to NASA. Continuing on, we are now on slide 43, and we can see some of the meteor showers that are going to be happening during the course of the LADEE science mission. As you also notice, the moon, in a number of cases, is not real favorable for us. The waxing crescent for the quadrantids is pretty thin. Other than that, we've got a great big bright moon. But even so, even on nights when there is not a meteor shower going, the folks at NASA's Meteoroid Environment Office who have been looking at these meteoroid impacts of the moon, with a 14-inch telescope, they're typically seeing 5 sporadic impacts a night. That's, you know, outside of meteor shower activity. So, again, it's good to be watching even when there is not a shower. Continuing on to the next slide, slide 44, radio observations of meteors. This brings up an interesting point. Even when the sky is bright or cloudy, you can still do meteor counts. You can even do them during the daytime through amateur radio. Ham radio operators have known for a long time that meteors, as they come in, leave an ionized trail that actually reflects radio signals, and they can actually hear a meteor through listening on their ham radios. And so you can do counts of radio meteors. An advantage of this, again, is lighting conditions, weather conditions, doesn't really matter. Moving on to slide 45, though, we see that, again, there is a preference. You'll detect more meteors listening between midnight and noon than from noon to midnight because, again, you want to be on the leading edge of the Earth as it moves through space. Slide 46, we see that there are a number of daytime showers that you can only detect via radio. These are very, very, very poorly characterized. So this is a really interesting opportunity to learn something more. There are probably a number of showers out there that we don't know about. So if you are a ham, if you are into amateur radio, this is also an opportunity for you to participate in the science of the LADEE mission. Continuing on, slide 47. As you interact with the public, as the Night Sky Network so ably does, one of the things you may want to let the public also know about is a wonderful new way they can explore the moon through the Lunar Mapping and Modeling Portal. This is a website that they can go to and get the latest information from LRO and from a wide variety of probes, and in very, very fine detail conduct their own explorations of the surface of the moon. Moving on to slide 48, an exciting thing is that they've just come out with a mobile version of LMMP, of the Lunar Mapping and Modeling Portal. This is called Moon Tours and allows you to explore the moon from the comfort of your own mobile device. Right now it works on iOS. We are anticipating, in fact, I'm beta testing right now the Android version, so we're looking forward to that coming up. So with that, we'll open it up to questions and go from there. Thank you.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 at this time. That's star 1 for questions. Record your name slowly and clearly when prompted. That's star 1 for questions. One moment, please. All right, our first question comes from Darian O'Brien. Your line is open.
Hello, Brian. That was an excellent presentation. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it. I have a question for you, two questions. One is the ability to interface the time encoder if you do have a telescope with a video camera hookup. Is there any software required to do that or any suggestions you have? I've never accomplished that piece of the puzzle on your example of lunar impact monitoring system configuration. And the other question is, how do you get a hold of the Lunar Scan software that's available as a free download?
Very, very, very good questions. In terms of getting the Lunar Scan software, if you go, if we look back on slide 36, which was when we first introduced the meteoroid impact observation campaign, there is a URL at the bottom that talks about how to get involved. And so if you go there, it will take you to links. Basically, NASA's Meteoroid Environment Office has a download of the software, so you can get it for free just by following the link. There's actually several links that you'll follow here to get a wide range of information. Now, there has been some changes lately with regards to the time encoders. And currently, probably the recommended time encoder is the IOTA VTI. And this is something that is used very commonly by our friends who do occultation timing. Maybe some of you are involved in this. And this is a nice self-contained little unit that takes as an input your analog video stream, and it will then add the time encoding to the proper channel of the video stream. That's already been established, so no, you don't need any special software. And then that video signal comes out of the output of the time encoder and plugs into the analog digital converter. So take a look at the IOTA VTI for your time encoding.
Thank you.
You bet.
Our next question comes from Carol Kiley. Your line is open.
Oh, hello, Brian. Earlier on, you mentioned about water being in the magma. Can you explain that a bit more?
Yes. We initially thought that the magma was going to be exceptionally, exceptionally dry. And sure enough, a lot of it was. But let's start out with some of the samples that were brought back by the Apollo 17 astronauts. You may remember in Apollo 17, one of the things that they discovered as they were wandering across the surface of the moon was this very strange orange soil.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they gathered that up, and it turned out to be beads of volcanic glass that had been erupted in fire fountains. And when they brought that back, of course, they analyzed the water content in those beads, and it was very, very low. But you would expect that because, well, if you're erupting magma in a vacuum, even if there were lots of volatiles in that, they would outgas very quickly. But inside those little beads, there were these tiny little crystalline cases, olivine crystals that had formed deep beneath the surface before this lava was erupted. Mm-hmm. And as these cases formed, they encapsulated some of that deep magma. And just within the past, 3 years, the technology was developed to actually go inside those tiny little magmatic inclusions and actually sample the magma that had been encapsulated in them and protected from outgassing.
Mm-hmm.
And to everybody's surprise, the water content in that magma is essentially the same as the water content that we find in lava that has erupted here on Earth at our mid-oceanic ridges. Mm-hmm. Nobody saw that coming.
Wow.
Yeah, the moon still continues to surprise us. Great question. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Lynn Zielinski. Your line is open.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I have two questions. One is, are you familiar with Radio Jove? And is it possible to detect the meteors in our atmosphere through Radio Jove? And my second question goes back to your beginning of your PowerPoint where you talked about the rays of light coming off the atmosphere of the moon is seen by the Apollo astronauts, and I was wondering if there were any actual images of that captured.
So going with your second question first, we have verbal descriptions and we have actual sketches. The most famous sketch was done by Gene Cernan. Now, there were some photographs taken, and if you look at the photographs, you don't see very much. But the situation is what I consider to be analogous to what many of you may be familiar with in terms of the Gegenschein. And for years and years and years and years, people would look up and they would, you know, from a dark sky location, you'd look up in the sky and you would see the Gegenschein. And people had an immensely hard time photographing the Gegenschein Now, more recently with the really high-powered CCD cameras, that's become easier. But for a long time, the Gegenschein was far easier to see than it was to record on a camera, especially a film-based camera. Keep in mind, film-based cameras are what we had aboard Apollo. And so what the astronauts were able to see actually ended up being far greater than what they were able to photograph. So there has been some analysis done of some of those photographs, and there may be something there, but we want better information. And so by flying down through that dust and sampling it, you know, if it's there, we're gonna find it. So that's we're going to try to answer this mystery from Apollo with the LADEE mission. In terms of Radio Jove, yes, I am familiar with it. Now, whether or not you could use that to detect meteors, possible. It depends on, I guess, the frequency you are tuned to, because what we want to listen to, actually, are terrestrial signals. We're using what's called forward scatter detection of meteors. So what you typically want to have the situation be is that you are tuned to a frequency of a transmitter that you do not have a line of sight to, that is over the limb of the Earth. And so you would normally not be able to hear that signal. But when the meteor occurs and creates that trail, then you can get a bounce, an indirect path, from this transmitter to your antenna. Now, in the case of Radio Jove, you're normally using a line of sight detection of your source, and you're tuned to a frequency that may not correspond to a transmitter that's just over your horizon. That doesn't mean that it couldn't happen. I have just heard that this is done commonly amongst the radio amateurs. In fact, they actually use this technique to be able to talk amongst each other over distances that they normally would not be able to. It'd be interesting to see if Radio Jove could be somehow used to do this. That's an interesting thought, Lynn, and I had not thought of that before. Thank you.
Okay. We have time for one more question, and then we're going to have to wrap up.
Our next question comes from John Cox. Your line is open.
Thank you for the interesting talk. I have a couple of questions. Was the operating altitude for your spacecraft governed by orbital mechanics, or was it science? And the other question is, could that plume you described that extends from the moon, can it be detected in Earth orbit, or is it too thin to be detected?
Great questions. So the our orbital altitude is determined by science. But yes, orbital mechanics does play a role. We are tied to the laws of orbital mechanics, but fortunately, because the moon has such a thin atmosphere, we can get down as low as we want. So we are going to start in this 20 to 75 kilometer range, but eventually, as we approach mission end, our orbit will degrade, and we will continue to collect information all the way down to the surface. We're operating in the 20 to 75 kilometer range. That should give us good access to the lunar atmosphere and lofted dust if it's there. But in operating around the moon, you have this really weird lumpy gravitational field, the mass cons that you have heard about. And those definitely act to degrade your spacecraft's orbit. And the lower you are, the more it will be degraded. So in order to have 100 days for our science mission, we want to stay for as long a period of time in that 20 to 75 kilometer range. Otherwise, we'd be burning our fuel to boost ourselves up so frequently that we would have a far shorter science mission. Please remind me again of the other part of your question.
I'm just curious about the plume, the atmospheric plume.
Yes. So this
extends
from
the moon. Can it be detected in Earth orbit, or is it too thin to be detected?
It has even been photographed. In fact, it was discovered photographically from here on the surface of the Earth. There was a team that was out of Boston University that was actually studying the sodium plume around Jupiter. And so they had a special camera with a special filter that was isolating the light of sodium. And they were looking at this glow of sodium around Jupiter in a very wide, wide-angle camera. And interestingly, one night, this bright blob kind of went through their field of view, and they thought, what in the world was that? And it turned out that that bright blob was actually in the anti-lunar position. It was essentially the moon. We were at new moon phase, and so directly opposite the sun and the moon, you had this bright patch that was going through the sky. What that meant was that we were passing through that tail and looking down the tail directly away from the moon and the sun. Because we're looking right down the tail, the column density was high, and we were actually able to see it. So it has been detected by professionals. What I would love to do would be to see the first amateur image of this phenomenon. Again, you would need, you know, a narrow filter centered on sodium. That's typically a line we try to avoid because of streetlights, but those filters do exist. And getting away from the lights and having a wide-angle view, you know, someone is going to be the first amateur to get that image, and boy, I'll be very excited when I see it. Does that answer your question?
Yes, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Awesome. That's great. That's all the time we have for questions this evening, and they were awesome. So thank you, Night Sky Network members, for your excellent questions, and a huge thank you, Brian, for giving us so much of your time and your excellent presentation. But before we sign off, let's have a drawing for our prize, the signed copy of How It Began, as well as a copy of the gorgeous Astronomical Site of the Pacific's calendar. Operator, can you remind us how to queue up? We'll take the lucky seventh caller.
All right. Once again, in order to queue up, you only need to press star one. That's star one. One moment.
And while we wait, I'd like to thank the Norton Books and the Astronomical Society of the Pacific for donating our prizes for tonight. And I am here actually downloading some of those lovely apps Brian was demonstrating earlier. I'm looking forward to trying them out over the next few weeks. So thank you again, Brian, for that.
Glad you're doing that.
As long as my girlfriend doesn't see my phone, she already makes fun of me for how many apps I have on there anyway.
All right, it looks like we have a winner.
Awesome.
Ron Kunkel, your line is open.
Hello.
Hi there. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I've listened to a number of these talks, and I find them very, very interesting. I continue to encourage other people to listen to them, too.
Cool. Thank you so much. Just send me an email at dprosper@astrosociety.org or the regular Night Sky Network email. And I will get you your shipping information and get your price sent to you ASAP. Thanks again. Congrats.
dprosper@ what was that?
Astrosociety.org.
Astrosociety.org.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Awesome. Look forward to it. And excellent. And that's it for tonight. Congratulations. And you can find this telecon along with many others on the Night Sky Network website under Astronomy Activities. Just search for telecon. Tonight's presentation with a full audio and written transcript will be posted by the end of this week. Good night, everyone, and keep looking up.
Thank you very much.
That does conclude today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect your lines at this time.